Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording from our October 20th service. Our guest speaker is Joseph Benarek. His sermon title is Heads or Tails at the Crossroads. The music following the sermon is Psalm 139, set by and performed by Katie Taylor. Thanks for listening.
One of the beautiful things about being at the men's retreat is you get to share a cabin with other men. And when the lights go out, you get to re-experience talking in the dark with people. And I was talking in the dark with one of my bunkmates who will remain nameless. And we got onto words that bothered him. And get this, the word amen just really got under his skin. And so I will just let everyone know here, if in the event that amen is a bothersome word for you, our sermon this morning ends with the word amen. So be prepared. The poet laureate of Unitarian Universalism is a woman named Mary Oliver, and this is her poem called The Journey, which has likely been read thousands upon thousands of times at Unitarian Universalist congregations around the world. The Journey by Mary Oliver. One day you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice. Though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles, mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible, it was already late enough and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. Little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. So we begin this morning's sermon with one of the world's most famous and effective prayers. It's a prayer likely prayed by millions of people this morning. At heart, the Serenity Prayer is about decisions and human wisdom. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. And true to form, at a UU service, after the first service, an avowed atheist handed me a serenity prayer that does without God. And I thanked him for that. But decisions. If ever you want to get into a fascinating, meaningful conversation with someone, just ask them, how do you make decisions? Now, I asked this recently to two young college students at a going-away party, a genderqueer person and a cisgender woman, and I got extremely different responses that essentially boiled down to rational data versus emotionally tuned intuition. One person described their process of decision-making as listing down pros and cons, fine-tuning goals and aspirations, and determining what, in fact, they needed to learn to move on with their life. It's a very rational, deliberate process that made good sense. And the other person felt their way into possibilities, imagining their future lives, and then making a swift and decisive choice and executing toward that choice, not looking back. Now, I admire this person's combination of emotions, imagination, and decisiveness. Now, both people, mind you, were working at the same summer internship at the same nonprofit, and both arrived at their decision to do the same thing in extremely different ways. And being the bright lights that they are, they, of course, turned the tables of the conversation and asked, "So, Joseph, how do you make decisions?" "This conversation isn't about me," I told them. "I'm doing field work for a presentation." And note here how I didn't say I was doing field work or research for a sermon. I chose to press the fog button on that religious word, sermon, and use the word presentation. And it is true, that conversation was field research. And at another point of the research stage for the sermon or presentation, I typed the phrase, "How many decisions do humans make each day?" into an internet search engine. A search engine, by the way, that doesn't track my searches. And I got this astonishing number, 35,000. 35,000 decisions in a single day. It is a blizzard of decisions. It's a tsunami of decisions. I find that number astonishing. And I definitely feel the pressure of 35,000 when I stand in the shampoo aisle at the grocery store and consider my myriad options. And I know what you're thinking. He's in the shampoo aisle? All right. Well, from that list of choices provided by the search engine, I click through to a blog post from Psychology Today, a trusted publication in my book, and it enumerated the many decisions that the author had made just that morning. Hit the snooze button or get out of bed. Coffee or tea, skirt or pants, walk to work, take the bus, etc., etc., etc. And still, the number 35,000 seemed absurdly huge to me, so I did a little math and put that big number into a more finite and understandable frame. In the course of a 24-hour day, there are 1,440 minutes, even counting sleep. If there are 35,000, if that 35,000 number holds, the average human being is making 24 decisions a minute, or 2 decisions every 5 seconds. And this assumes that you're making decisions while sleeping, minute after minute after minute after minute, consciously and unconsciously, I guess. And note that comfortable, comforting egress that I just slipped in there, the phrase, "I guess." And so I burrowed a little deeper into the research and found a very instructive and well cross-referenced blog post entitled "Basis for Why We Make the 35,000 Decisions a Day Statistic." Now, it seems that a number of people like me were incredulous over this number. Now, this article, which solicited help from readers the world over, was hard-pressed to find any peer-reviewed published research that supported that number and led in another direction entirely, suggesting that the number of decisions the average human being makes per day, conscious decisions, was more on the order of 70. Not even close to 35,000, nanoscopic in compared to 35,000. And so here we are, at a blunt juncture at the very beginning of a presentation and/or sermon on decision-making. We get to decide whether we believe in the big number or the small number. Heads, 35,000. Tails, 70. Tails again, 70. Now, my guess is if we did this coin toss every morning, that the coin would always land on tails. And speaking of which, as a kid, did you ever do that theological coin-tossing exercise to determine once and for all whether there was an all-powerful God or a Lord above? Because it makes sense, perfect sense, that if there's an all-powerful God, she would make the coin land on whatever you called, even if you called edge. Now, I tried this in my early teens, and I quickly discovered that either there wasn't a God, there wasn't an all-powerful God, that God didn't want me to know for sure whether there was a God, or that I was using the wrong research tool, and I should be acquiring a Ouija board or a tarot deck or a magic eight ball. Is there a Lord above who created and controls the universe? Reply hazy, ask again. So, even the magic eight ball has a hard time with the God question. And in her TED talk, the psychoeconomist Sheena Iyengar asserts that the average number of choices that the typical American reports making is about 70 in a typical day. Now, to clarify, a psychoeconomist is a person who studies how people choose. It makes perfect sense that psycho and economist are linked together with a hyphen, and it is very important for the macro capitalist system. Now think corporations and marketers and retailers of all stripes who want your credit card to swipe in their direction, to figure out how people choose, to know precisely how they select and create products and placements in the marketplace that lead to or favor a consumer to choose their product and have green energy, aka money, flow abundantly in their direction. Now, I was first introduced to this idea when I was a Rotary exchange student in Helsinki, Finland. One of my host fathers was the head of a national grocery store chain, and he regaled me with inside information about how grocery stores were designed psychologically. Did you ever notice, he asked, how cookies and candies are within reach of that toddler strapped into the cart? Those little guys can reach and point and grab. And the mother, and I remember distinctly that he used the word mother rather than parent, the mother is highly motivated to keep that child calm, so she will buy a treat. Cha-ching. It was one of the most impactful conversations that I've ever had in my life, because at that moment, my naivete vaporized. From that point forward, I knew that the place called grocery store was vibrating with psychological research. It was drenched with ideas and schemes informed by psychoeconomists. Color, placement, lighting, texture, size, architecture, size of cart, all of it. And what better place to meditate on decision-making than at a grocery store? Your average Safeway or QFC has nearly 50,000 products to choose from. 50,000. Now count how many products you have in your cart the next time you do a big shopping trip. My guess, it'll be around 50, which means you didn't choose 49,950 other products for whatever reason. And so how did you handle this blizzard of choices? Well, basically by knowing what you are not going to choose and not choosing it. Now, rolling through the grocery store with a basket of choices, it gives me a feeling of power performing all this not choosing. And also, as a part of research for this sermon, I did a simple visualization at one of the grocery stores in town, and I invite you to now do a similar visualization. This is called using your imagination. So imagine that you're standing in the middle of a standard 50,000 item grocery store and the freezer aisle disappears. And then the dairy section, the deli, the magazine racks, the produce section all disappear. Cereal aisle, shampoo, pet food, soda, beer, greeting cards, household cleansers, all disappear. Everything gone, except what's in your basket. And then your basket disappears. You are now alone in an empty, hollowed out building. Then the roof and the walls disappear. All the surrounding buildings disappear. You are completely alone in the emptiness. And you look down and you discover that you are at the intersection of two roads. Welcome to the crossroad. And now the crossroad, where you're standing, is a classic image in literature and art and mythology and song and film of all the roads and all the paths and all the byways of the world. Here you are, finally arrived at this intersection with a decision to make. The roads disappearing off into the direction, into the distant horizons of the four cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west. A decision, a forced choice, on or off, yes or no, up or down, in or out, left or right, north or south. And let's just say this choice is important. Let's say it has consequences, this way or that way, this life or that life. Now, if we levitate skyward from this scene and look down with our hawk's eye, we see a person poised at the precise center of a giant X, that traditional marker of where the treasure is hidden. So let's imagine life's crossroad decision as a place where treasure exists, where decisions are considered, decisions are made, and life is lived in a chosen direction. This way. Which means, of course, the unlived life lives forever unrealized in that direction. Now, the energy of the unlived life, the wonderments about what could have happened if you went east rather than west, can become corrosive and cause great anxiety for people. I have a friend who harnessed that energy of the unlived life, and he took himself to a keyboard and he produced a book that he called a novel, though in reality it was a thinly veiled memoir imagining his unlived life, or more accurately, one of his possible unlived lives. And while it's technically impossible to have memories about events that didn't happen, writing a memoir cloaked as a novel was a good practice for him. He took special delight that his friends were actually worried about him because he wrote his own death scene and even composed an obituary. It turns out that he dies from a massive coronary while riding his bike and, quote, fell into a yard where he could not be seen by passing traffic. Now, somewhat predictably, the book is called The Other Road, and the epigraph is a verse from Robert Frost's poem, The Road Not Taken. And here's the epigraph. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. Now Frost's Two Roads Diverged is the famous crossroad in American poetry. In American music, that the is owned by Crossroad Blues by Robert Johnson. Now, listening close to that classic song, the original and several cover versions, was my favorite part of researching for this sermon and or presentation. And Crossroad Blues begins with these lines: I went to the crossroad, fell down on my knees. I went to the crossroad, fell down on my knees. Ask the Lord above, have mercy now, save poor Bob if you please. Now consider that image of a person on their knees at the crossroad seeking mercy and being saved from what we don't know, something bad, I reckon. The song is deep, it's layered, and you've likely all heard it at some point in your life because it's been covered by dozens of artists over the past 80 years. There are 5 verses, and while the character never leaves the crossroad, he does a lot while he's hanging out there. He falls to his knees. He tries to flag a ride and to get away. He stands with the sun going down. He implores someone to run and get a friend, and then in the final line, he believes that he is sinking down. Lord, I'm standing at the crossroad, babe. I believe I'm sinking down. So with sinking down in the final verse and Lord above in the first, the song expands that crossroad image along the earth's surface to a powerful dimensionality and depth. Realms of above and below, life and death, heaven and hell. And consider the first words of that first line. I went to the crossroad. Not I wound up at the crossroad or I stumbled onto the crossroad. I went to the crossroad. There's intention here. I went to the crossroad and here is my life, on my knees, asking the Lord above for mercy, then trying to flag a ride in the second verse and get the hell out of there. But he's caught. He cannot leave this place of major decision. And there is a profound and agonizing sense that he is beyond the power of agency, beyond the power of choosing. Because this is a blues song, after all. The feeling is one of desperation, of being stuck, trapped, of needing some actor more powerful than himself, some divine aid and assistance to provide mercy and saving. Or not. I believe I'm sinking down. Now, this crossroad is not about flipping a coin and making a binary choice and experiencing the results of a specific, rational human decision. This crossroad moment is about living and dying, and I would argue spiritually living and dying. And we have arrived at the dimensional crossroad of the human condition. And here, at this moment, with a person on their knees seeking mercy, trapped, pleading toward the above while sinking down, we end where we began with the serenity prayer, a prayer prayed by millions just this morning. At heart, this prayer is about wisdom and human decisions. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, wisdom to know the difference. That word, difference, the last word in Frost's poem, and that has made all the difference. And the last word in the serenity prayer, and the wisdom to know the difference. Now the treasures hidden at the X of this crossroad can be mercy, courage, acceptance, serenity, and the wisdom to choose a life where change, when needed, is a possible choice. Now, as for our hero, it is quite likely that he is about to experience a night at the crossroad with moonrise, Milky Way, night sounds, hellhounds, in short, a long, dark night of the soul. And if the mercy he is pleading for comes, it will be at the first light of a new day, a revelation. This way. Amen.
Searched me out and known me. You know my rising up and my lying down. You trace my journeys and my resting places and are acquainted with all my ways. Indeed, there is not a word upon my lips, but you, O earth, know it altogether. If I climb up to heaven, you are there. If the grave be my bed, you are there also. If I take the wings of the morning and fly to the uttermost parts of the deep, even there your hand will lead me, and your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will cover me, and the light around me turn to night, darkness is not dark to you, the night bright as the day. Darkness is not dark to you. Darkness and light to you both are alike. For you yourself have created my inmost parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. My body was not hidden from you while I was being made in secret. While I was being made in secret and woven in the depths of the earth. While I was being made in secret and woven in the depths of the earth, and woven in the depths of the earth.